Chris Ryan, thanks so much for coming and being on my podcast, Uncomfortable Truths.
It's a pleasure, Pradeepa.
And I came and saw your show about 10 days ago, and I related in a big way.
Did you?
Yeah, big way. Well, we were just talking about how you didn't always do dark comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because basically, because there might be listeners that haven't seen your stuff.
Yeah, it's funny, I don't see myself as dark at all. It's funny, you don't see yourself as others see you necessarily. You might have moments where you have a glimpse.
Yeah.
And you realise, oh, suddenly I think I'm doing a dark show. But it's not. It's got heart, and I'm a sook, and I'm a wuss, and I'm, you know, like I'm a softie. But yeah, there are dark, I guess my truths are not comfortable sometimes.
I don't think anyone, but Brad Oakes actually says that no truths are comfortable.
Mm.
I think a lot of truths are uncomfortable, which is why I think there's so much bullshit flying around the world.
Because it's easier.
Well, it is. Yeah. People just don't want to, they don't want to face, I don't know if you've had it, but many people just don't want to talk, have those tough conversations when things get awkward and pretend it didn't happen. And then, of course, that makes a toxic relationship at the end of the day. So I think you were like facing stuff that's, well, I walked in and you were talking about something about how you didn't feel successful in your life compared to your dad.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was based on, your show's based loosely around your dad's memoirs.
Yeah, correct.
Even though he's still alive,
yes, I believe. Yes, he is, yes. Which I found adorable and funny. Like, the fact that he wrote his memoirs, like, when he told me, I was like, oh, dear, this is going to be hard to read, you know. And also, I sort of didn't want to. I was like, oh, God, I already know this guy. Like, hasn't he had enough airtime?
Yeah.
And then I did start reading it, and I could see it wasn't so much that he wrote it for us. He wrote it for himself, I think. I mean, he said he wrote it for us because he didn't know his parents' story. They never talked about how they felt about things or what happened in their lives. He wanted to know more about, with his parents gone, obviously a long time ago, and at this stage in his life, he's 82 this year, I think, he felt like he was missing those stories. He wanted to connect with his parents. So he wanted to leave something for us to connect to once he's gone. And so I guess, but reading it, I got to see a different side of Dad, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose there's that. We are so often family members, we just see them as the relationship and who they're supposed to be and stuff like that. And sometimes you need to take a step back as an adult to observe who they actually are.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's weird.
Yeah.
But
is that going to be a problem?
Well, that's why I shut the door.
Okay.
I mean, the door, the window. Look, I've had music coming in on it. Seems to be a pretty good microphone.
Right.
Seems to be all right. And I was really struck. There were two things that struck me within the first 5 minutes. One was I walked in a tiny bit late, and it was you talking about how you didn't feel that you've been successful. You weren't a success. And yet here you are doing a show in the town hall at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, which is many comedians' aspiration for success.
It's very lucky, I know that. I guess it was more in the context of financial success.
I can relate.
Yeah, I think most people that are in the arts can relate. It was more that I go and bludge at my parents' house every summer holidays rather than paying for a holiday because I'm not financially successful. That was the context of that.
Oh, did I miss that context?
Yeah. So I realise I have a lot of breaks and I'm fortunate, but it's just, I literally go and spend every summer holidays with my parents, which is strange for a 48-year-old, don't you think?
Well, it isn't, Mm. I mean, we go down to Apollo Bay. Do you know where Apollo Bay is? If you go around to Geelong and go past Geelong and down the coast where the 12 Apostles are. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. And we started going down there because we didn't have anywhere else to go. We started camping, put our son into the little nippers with the Surf Lifesaving Club and all that. So there's we've gone down there year after year doing the family thing. And we've gotten to know a lot of other parents down there. And the number of people down there that have a family holiday home down there.
Yeah, right.
And they go down there because every year and do exactly what you're doing. And in fact, that we just count them as lucky.
Yeah.
Because after 5 years of camping, our tent was in shreds because they get big winds down there. And we finally started renting.
Yeah.
It was very bloody expensive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know? It is. And, especially after the couple of years we've had where, work has been insecure for a lot of people, you can't really splash out on... You can't travel anywhere anyway.
Yeah.
I'm very grateful for my parents' luxury beach house that they let us stay at, but I know it's not my work that's got that.
Right.
And I also know a lot of people don't have that. So I'm very aware of my privilege.
Yeah, yeah, you know, yeah. It didn't come across as ungrateful.
Yeah, yeah, good.
Yeah, I just missed the context. And I know what it means to be at Town Hall, and I know what it means to have been nominated or and won the awards and so on. I'm being a comedian. Perhaps the rest of the audience wouldn't. It just struck me as the irony.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
We're never happy, are we?
No.
No human is ever, well, no.
We're happy for
no
a short
thinking,
time.
Yeah, no thinking human is ever satisfied with their lot, I don't think. I think we're always striving for something we don't have. Well, a lot of people are. Some people have found a way to just be all like, chill. I haven't.
Me neither. The reason it struck so with me is that I have that gnawing sense of not having... Because I did well at school, got A's and B's at school, got into uni.
Yep.
It was all supposed to pan out. And, you know, through whatever the reasons are, me travelling for 4 years, and as my husband said, I didn't just take a gap year, I took a gap decade.
Yep.
You know, meanwhile, all other people that I went to uni with or my age were working and buying houses and all that sort of stuff, and I was being a hippie.
Yeah.
And then you kind of have a kid and get to middle age, you go, what the fuck happened? Where'd they get all that money from?
But it's true, you know, like we don't know what we're doing. We don't. And just because you have a certain age on you, it doesn't mean you've got more wisdom than someone younger necessarily. Like we can manage to fuck things up pretty well as older people, you know.
We can.
And even in a more complex ways, sadly.
Yeah, indeed, because we usually have more responsibility and more people relying on us. I mean, theoretically, we're meant to learn from our mistakes and other people's mistakes, but we don't always do
that. Not always possible, is it?
No.
Sometimes you'll just follow your instinct and it's fucking wrong.
Yes. Yes. Yes, and sometimes you're just, without realising it, following what your parents did in a different sort of fashion. And it's sort of, and you kind of go, how do
I? Or you might have a similar relationship to what your parents did.
A lot of people do.
Yeah. And because it's what you know and it's what you're comfortable with, even if you're uncomfortable with it, you know?
Yeah.
It's weird. And I think the sad part about getting self-awareness and being interested in what makes people tick is you realise your mistakes, but you're not necessarily able to fix them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's analogous to like the tech at our show, because I've been a musician in the past. We've had a band and everything. I know enough to know what the problems are with the tech, but not enough to know how to fix it.
And this is, I think, a theme of my whole show.
Yeah, right.
Is about having just enough knowledge to identify problems, but not to be able to fix them. You know,
it's a frustrating situation.
It is. Yeah.
But I think life is a problem-solving endeavour, really. I've heard on podcasts that, you know, with people that have done research and scientists what was my point there? I have mental blanks and I have them on stage.
Oh, mate, I do too. God, all the time.
That we always seem to be striving for something, and I can't tell. Is that what we were just talking about? Striving, sort of being uncomfortable all the time a little bit?
We're seeing problems, we can't fix them.
Oh, yes. That happiness doesn't come from sitting on a beach and having time out, which is what we think.
I know. That's why holidays suck. I can't relax on holidays. I'm like, I'm stuck here with my head on this beach.
Exactly.
What the hell?
Exactly. Mm. And I've been at a resort many years ago. Everyone that was sitting around the pool was on a tablet or a phone.
Yeah.
Can't turn off the head. So apparently where we're most happy is when we are problem solving.
Right. Is that right?
Yeah. But I'd imagine that would be problem solving in a way that we can figure out what's going on. I mean, that I wouldn't include, like, me trying to figure out a computer, not happy.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. But if you're doing something that you know just enough to be able to work on the next problem and then solving that and solving that, apparently that's where we're at. So, which makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure how much problem solving I'm doing in my life. Probably not enough because I'm not that happy. No, I'm kidding. I am pretty happy, but I like to feel like a sense of purpose. Yeah. Like I like to have... Sometimes if I've got a day stretched out before me, like here in Melbourne, I've been here for so long, it feels like I live here now.
Yeah.
God, I love it.
Oh, good. I really love it.
Yeah. And I sort of will make a little list in my mind of what I, just to give myself some structure, because a structureless life, whilst it might sound good to people who are supremely busy and have a terrible job or work really hard, there are challenges to not having structure in your life as well. You can just float along and and not produce anything, not do anything useful with your time, and then hate yourself for it. So I guess I make a little list, you know, of simple things. Like I wanted to, I'm staying at this tiny Airbnb. It's looking a bit ratty and I've been there nearly a month and I thought, no, I'm going to fucking clean this thing today. I vacuumed before I came here and I'm going to clean the bathroom when I get back. And just, you know, just to make it feel like I have some sense of normality in my life.
I know exactly what you mean. As soon as my show had finished, even though I was flat chat with the show and trying to get people to come to the show, when it was over, I was like, all right, I felt empty and it's like, what's next? And then I'm like, oh, it's such a mess around here, and just started getting into the next project.
Isn't it bizarre though? Like, I will whinge about housework, but there I am doing it voluntarily to feel good. What a fucking weirdo.
But you're not the only one.
The mind is bizarre, isn't it?
It is. It is. As Brad Oakes says, it's we were talking about comedy and how we feel comfortable and psychology, because comedy's got a lot to do with psychology. And he go, and then at the end he said, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much of it is under the water. Now, you're talking about, this relates to comedy, but it's really about having a sense of meaning and purpose in your life, isn't it?
Yeah.
And and problem solving, well, comedy.
I suppose that's a problem.
Yes.
If you look at my bank account, it is.
Well, the problem solving is, how do you get the audience to laugh and how do you get better?
Yeah.
That's what I treat it
absolutely
as.
And that's the bit I love about it, is the constant challenge of writing new material, of honing it and getting it better, of figuring out what works, what doesn't work, and just meeting deadlines. You know, like, it's just the deadlines that keep me writing.
Yeah.
You know, new gigs, new shows that I have to produce each year. And
yeah, right.
Yeah. So deadlines are very helpful in creative life.
Oh, I've got to get more deadlines.
Yeah,
into my
you got to set deadlines. Otherwise, you just will let everything faff about until it's too late.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. Now, you tell me you got into, can you tell me when you got into comedy and how you got into comedy?
I entered Raw Comedy in 2012 in Canberra, where I live.
Oh, you live in Canberra?
Yeah.
I thought it was Sydney.
No.
Okay, Canberra, great.
So I just always wanted to have a go at stand-up. I just loved it. When I was a kid, I used to love things like the Paul Hogan show and, you know, I just loved the idea of making people laugh with your words, you know, and I liked the stage. I used to sing in a band too, a cover band. And, so I was comfortable on stage. I knew I could do that part. I had made people laugh historically in my life. So I thought, yeah, I'm capable of making people laugh. And if I could combine the two, let's see if that works. So I got sort of addicted to comedy as soon as I started, you know.
So your first gig was Raw?
Yeah.
And did you do well?
I won the Canberra Heat with my first set. but then I went on to suck in Sydney, right, because I didn't know what I was doing.
Right.
You know, but it was so deluded, you know. I was like, oh, wow, I'm a natural. This is amazing. I'm the best. And then I get to Sydney and I realise people have been doing it for years and going to open mics and prepping for this, and they know how to do comedy. You know, they know the structure and the rhythms and they know how to construct a joke, and I was just flying by the seat of my pants, you know.
Yeah.
And so I went away after that and just kept working at it, kept doing open mics in Canberra, opened rooms, ran rooms, did emceeing, built up shows, you know, started with split shows with four, then two, and then at solo shows.
So which festivals were you doing these shows at?
Oh, just Canberra Comedy Festival.
Oh, you have a Canberra Comedy
Festival?
Yeah,
there's a Canberra
Comedy.
Sorry,
I'm so ignorant about Canberra.
No, not at all. Canberra has a wonderful comedy scene. It's not enormous. There's not a lot of rooms, but the rooms that run are great, and the people doing comedy there for the most part are doing really interesting, intelligent stuff. They have really complicated day jobs, and then their comedy comes out at night, you know.
Huh.
Yeah, it's and there's a very intelligent crowd in Canberra. They're really well educated. Like, the stats show.
They're all
like highly educated. They like intellectually challenging stuff. Not that I can fucking give it to them, but there are, you know, there's an audience there that's a really smart one.
Are most of the people in Canberra somehow associated with government?
There's a lot that work for the public service.
Right.
So in government departments, you know, shuffling paper around, really boring jobs.
Right.
In my view, I've done them. They're boring.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. But they're educated people and they've got a keen mind.
Yeah, they just need to tap into live comedy more, as everyone does, in my view.
Absolutely.
Instead of just on Netflix and stuff like that. But
yeah, come out and see it live. It's a whole different experience, isn't it?
Mm. So, yeah, I just did comedy there for 10, I think it was like 7 years before I started to actually spread out and go to Sydney. And so I started I did a split show at the Sydney Comedy Festival with three buddies of mine.
Which year was that?
That was like 2000 and I think it was 17.
Right, okay.
Or 18.
So that's like five years ago.
And then I did a Sydney Fringe show, which was tough. It was just a solo and no one knew me. So I remember one night I had four people in the audience and I, in between the jokes, like in my own head, I was thinking, you're mental. This is nuts. What are you doing? What a waste of time. But then the next year I got, booked for a run in the Comedy Store and I got supported with this new faces kind of program for Sydney Comedy Festival. And it was actually the Sydney Comedy Festival that really just, I guess, saw me and supported me. And I got to do my first gala. Well, my first gala was with Canberra Comedy Festival. I did a couple of galas there, but then it was Sydney Comedy Festival Gala at the Enmore Theatre 2019 where I had my first film set and that was a big deal. There was like five cameras. There was, over 1,000 people in that audience. It was massive and it was the best gig I had done to date,
Wow. It was that in 2019?
19, yeah.
And that
that was the year I got newcomer at Sydney. Yeah.
Fantastic.
It was an amazing year. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
What was the name of your show that year?
Bogus.
Bogus. Mm. And so you'd already done several shows in Canberra before?
I'd done a couple. I'd done one called Grey Matter, which I really liked that one. I'd done another one I can't even remember. Or maybe it was Bogus. Yeah, maybe just two. Yeah.
So you'd done one or two with other people?
I'd done a split with four. Like four of us, and I'd done a split with another woman, Edwina Nelson, and then I just went solo.
Then you went solo after that. And was the show that, what was it called, Bogus?
Yeah.
Was that your first Sydney?
At Sydney, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's how you get in the running for a newcomer is you do your first show.
Oh, right. Now, is Sydney a bit different? Is anyone allowed to do a show at Sydney or is it more of a curated?
Oh, no. You apply. Anyone can apply. Yeah,
really?
Absolutely.
I was under this impression that it was...
No, I think Brisbane Comedy Festival is curated.
Right.
But Canberra, Sydney, Perth, as far as I know, Adelaide, you can just apply.
Now, I'm such an... I feel... This is weird. I feel like an American at the moment, not knowing what the hell is going on.
But why would you know? Like, unless you're obsessed. If you've got your own life to lead and comedy's just a sidebar, why would you know all the admin details of festivals, It's boring.
Because I do comedy, but I feel like because I do comedy in Melbourne, I don't know what's going on anywhere else because we've got the International Comedy Festival. I didn't even know that all the other states had comedy festivals.
Okay.
But that's also because up until this point, I haven't felt like I'm in a position to travel.
Yep. Yeah, I get that.
With a job and a kid and all that. So, but he's 14 turning 15 and this year I kind of thought it's time to branch out.
I totally get you. That's the same thing that happened to me. Like my kids are 16 and 18 now.
And
my partner is the main sort of carer at home because I travel for work now. And it's only because of this age and because my partner retired that I'm able to have this career now. I wanted to have it 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But I couldn't.
Yeah.
Because I had a family.
Yeah.
That I wanted to be around.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, because when I started, I was about six and I just started doing it one night a week, then maybe two nights a week.
Yeah.
Because I thought, he's not going to be this age forever.
Yeah.
But the comedy scene will be there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, right. Mm. So you started when you were 38.
Yep.
Then, did your stuff in Canberra, then moved on to Sydney. And kids are getting more independent, all that stuff.
Yep.
And won Best Newcomer.
Yeah.
Now that must have changed it.
Oh,
Did that change everything?
It really it changed how I felt about myself, which it shouldn't have in a perfect world.
But it that would be acknowledgement from other people changes everything, it seems.
Yeah, it did help a lot with my confidence. And because there had been, obviously, when you do such a strange art form that's so alone, like you do it by yourself.
Yeah.
And you might have friends, of course, but ultimately you're on your own and you have to back your show. You have to believe in your material. You have to trust that you've done the work and you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
But it's not until, for me, it wasn't really until I started getting those really big gigs that I really, and the award, of course, that I realised, hopefully, that it, others knew I was good. And yeah. It's hard even to say that, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're trained not to say that about ourselves.
I think particularly here in Australia.
Mm. So it was really a very encouraging thing. I was shook, you know, like it was it was unbelievable for me. It was a dream come true. And I'm enormously humbled by it. And,
yeah.
Because there's always brilliant comedians out there all the time.
It's
subjective. It's just, and that's the thing about awards, and that there are millions of people that deserve them, but why do you get it that year, or why does that person get it? Who knows, you know? Who knows? I don't know.
I was hearing Johnny Katz is another comedian here in Melbourne. He's got a podcast and he interviews other comedians. They were talking about how the line with comedy is non-linear. It's all over the place. Mm. You could be here today and a year from now be there, or haven't done, you know, it's so much depending also on who recognises you and gives you bigger and better gigs, which is basically what happened.
The bigger and better gigs, you know, the strange thing about that is I feel like everyone thinks they can do them. Like, you know, like when you get to a certain stage, you think, well, I could do that. I could do the gala. You know, I think, don't you think a lot of people think that?
I do, yes. Yeah. I haven't talked with people about it, but
I think there would be plenty of comedians who would think I could fucking do the gala.
Yeah.
And they probably could. I don't know. I don't know how you get to that position where you get offered those big gigs. I wish I could deconstruct it so that there was an easy pathway, but
I don't think there is.
I think it is consistency. I think you have to smash those short sets. I think you have to smash those club sets and show that you're a reliable, you know, a solid, you will not drop the ball for that real critical. I don't actually even know, to be honest.
No, what I've heard before is that what bookers are looking for is consistency.
Mm.
Because most comedians can smash at some point.
Mm. It's absolutely.
But then you might have five, three, 10 gigs in between.
Mm.
And then what you got to try and do is increase the number that you're smashing and decrease the number.
That's it. And also I think there's a, I would say, because I used to work in events and stuff and comms, and when you're booking someone for a big event, you want, like a corporate gig, for example, let's say, you're not going to get someone who's an absolute brilliant genius but mentally off the charts and untrustworthy, because you've got a $20,000 gig on the line, you know what I mean? You're going to get someone that's stable and reliable and will show up on time, sober, do their time, be respectful. And that might sound really boring, but that's fucking critical for these sorts of jobs.
Yeah. I think what you just said there is of incredible benefit for any comedian that's wanting to progress or keep doing gigs and get better
gigs. There are so many just absolute stars in the open mic scene. I know this. I've seen them.
Yeah.
I saw like Billy Styles, for example. I don't know if you've seen him.
Yeah.
He's fucking great.
Yes, I know he is. Right? Yeah.
There are so many like just stars.
Yeah.
And these people want to know how to get to the next level.
Yeah.
And I don't know the answer, but the only thing I have experienced is, you show up on time, you're sober, you're consistent.
Yep.
You're respectful. You do your time. You don't go long. You don't go short.
Like that
you
one.
Fucking, you keep to time.
Yep.
You respect the booker. Yep. You know, like you treat others well. You know, the sober thing is really important because there's a lot of grog in the comedy scene, you know.
Yeah.
And I fucking love it. Don't worry. And I've fucked it up a couple of times. But it's really important not to drink. For me, not to drink before a show. And just keep it fucking professional, you know. It's a job.
Yeah, it is a job. It's interesting. There are some comedians that can't seem to get on stage without a drink, and then that, of course, can lead to drinking too much.
You just got to figure what you're doing it for. Like, if you just want to have fun and express yourself, go for it. But if you're looking to sort of step up to that next thing, that is one way to help
project
the image of a professional that wants the spot. You
if
know?
You're going to step up in your comedy, you kind of need to step up in yourself.
Yeah.
Because I've found, I'm at the point that I'm doing open mic gigs, but I'm getting a decent gig here and there, just a spot here and there. Excuse me. And what I'm finding is whatever it is in my comedy that's holding me back is a part holding me back in my whole life.
I know.
You know, not wanting to invite people out of fear of rejection for a start.
Yeah.
You know, saying that I'm going to work on comedy but get distracted and do some housework instead because I don't want to sit.
I love comedy, but I fucking hate sitting down writing. Sometimes I will do everything except do that. And it's like, what are you doing, idiot?
I know.
It's so annoying. But it's funny you say that comedy as in life. Like, I find that about chess. I play online chess.
I remember you talking about online chess in your show.
But it's actually interesting. I'm not the only person to observe this, but in chess, the way you play chess is often the way you live your life.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, it's like you can be like this, you know, aggressive kind of instinct mover that just moves really quickly and doesn't think things through. That's my life. That is my life story.
That's me. Yeah, that's me too.
That's why I'll be always shit at chess. I'm not strategic. I'm not patient. I won't wait and figure out the best option with time.
Yeah.
I'll fucking go, nah, I'm playing. Let's play. Let's keep going.
That's me.
You know, and it's just, what? You know, like I know that that's how I live my life.
Yeah.
And I know the answer to fix it. You think I implement it? Fuck no.
I wanted to ask you, so having said that, had you been going to Sydney on a semi-regular basis and doing the open mics and also the comedy, did you say you did the comedy store?
Yeah.
Now, that was before you received your award?
Yeah.
Right, so the scene in Sydney had already gotten to know you a bit?
Yeah, I think, well, the thing is this, I suppose I'm not, like, it's not a secret that Century is my management agency. And they run the Comedy Store. They run the Sydney Comedy Festival. They run the Enmore.
Right.
So some of the best gigs in Sydney are run by Century.
Right.
Okay. And once they identified me, I suppose.
At what point did they approach you?
Well, the funny thing was in Canberra in 2018, I think it was, or 17, I did a solo show at the Civic Pub, which was this great comedy venue, the longest running comedy club in Canberra. It was 11 years. It stopped working this year because the pub has to put pokies in the room instead of running comedy because of money, which sucks shit, but that's life. I did this solo headline show at
Was that during the Canberra comedy?
No, it was just a headline club spot, you know, but I turned it into a bit of a festival show. I did about a 45-minute set.
Right.
And one of my friends and a good man in Canberra, a guy called Dave Graham, who helps run the Canberra Comedy Festival, he got one of Century's tour managers to come and watch my show.
Did you know this was happening?
Yeah, he told me.
Right.
And his name was Tom Downey and he's a brilliant, lovely man. And he liked it, you know, and he mentioned it to the people that manage the store and I got a spot at the store.
Yep.
And then it went kind of from there.
Yeah. What I'm kind of seeing is that, well, in this industry, it's not a set path and you can't give anybody a set path and say, do this and this and you'll be good. It'll be good. It's so much about someone, like in a very small way. I saw your show and I heard you and I loved it and I heard you say I'd love to do it. You know, I love podcasts because people listen to me and I'm sitting there going, I'm going to have to message you tomorrow because I'd love to have you on my podcast. Now, I'm not going to clearly make you famous, but this is a very small example of me going, I really like what you're doing. Can you come and do this with me?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what those guys were doing.
Yeah, it's true.
Inviting you to the store, inviting you into their agency because they resonate with your comedy. And obviously they're looking at whether the audience is laughing, but it would have to, I would imagine, on some level resonate with them personally. Would you say that's
I'm not
the
sure.
Case
I think
not?
That if I'm not sure what the job of management is, I suppose they have to identify what they think is a need in the market.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like everyone's looking for what demographic are you representing? You know, like who do you appeal to as a comedian?
Right.
Right. So like,
perhaps
they didn't have a middle-aged mother on their books, which they didn't.
Right.
And that's what I am.
That is, yeah, that's what I am as well. And when I first heard of you before you came down here, because I saw you, and I saw new best newcomer at Sydney, and I saw a photo of you.
You thought that older.
I went, a middle-aged cis white woman is winning an award? I was really kind of like, whoa, because in this day and age it's...
Well, older women are traditionally invisible.
Yes.
I absolutely don't want that.
No. Have you heard of a comedian in Melbourne called Lisa Sharp?
Yeah.
Have you heard her material about being invisible?
Oh, I'm not sure that I have. I think I met Lisa. She did one of my online gigs during lockdown. I just don't remember. Sorry, but yes.
I don't want to ruin her material, but she talks about how middle-aged women become invisible, and then she does some gags.
It's true.
It is.
But the thing is, women our age buy tickets, right? Yeah. They're the ones organising the groups to go and see comedy. They're the ones buying the ticket for their husband or their partner.
Yes.
So it's actually a really important demographic to target.
Yeah.
If you're trying to sell tickets to comedy.
Yeah.
And say your truth or whatever. I hope
this awareness spreads to Melbourne.
Yeah.
It
still happens. Like you would look at ticket sales in Melbourne. I guarantee you most women are the ones buying tickets.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Because in my experience, it's usually women, as you said, that are organising.
They're organising.
Organising social stuff.
Yeah, totally.
Always. Guys just like to turn up to whatever's been organised.
Yeah, they're chill. They're just like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was delighted that it was not a barrier. The fact that I was 40, I think I was 46 when it happened.
Yeah.
No,
it's fantastic. And after seeing your stuff, I'm like, oh, yeah, now I see why.
No, thanks. That's nice.
Yeah, I really, Lisa Gattenby had already told me, but that she'd seen you. You've done gigs with her, is that right?
Well, this was just online. So I did an online open mic that I ran during lockdown, the last one. Just to keep people creative. And I also just extended the invitation to any comedians in lockdown states.
Yes.
And so I got a few people from interstate to do these online Zoom gigs that I ran, just to do some material, just to have some outlet and feel connected on some level, you know.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, heaps of Melbourne people did Zoom.
Mm.
I didn't do Zoom myself because I can't remember what I got into, like reading and writing out goals for my life and reflections. And I kind of, when the lockdowns came, I'd kind of go read the books I hadn't read
good
for a while.
On you.
Do the deep reflection
great.
And stuff.
Good
yes.
on you.
It has been great.
Yeah.
Some stuff got shifted and this podcast got born
good.
Out of that as well.
Yeah.
But Zoom gigs didn't attract me. I felt like because of the time delay with the camera and so on, that it wouldn't actually foster that feeling on stage.
Oh, yeah, it's not the same as the stage.
It's not the same.
It was a tough substitute, but it was good enough for me. Yeah.
Oh, helped a lot of people keep going.
It did.
I think maybe because I was also working. I worked all through lockdown because I work as a cook at a childcare centre and we're in essential service. So I was still having my normal life in a lot of ways, except for the gigs.
Yeah.
And as much as I do like gigs, I'm not addicted to them.
Not a gig pig. Yeah, I know. Me either, actually. And I don't know whether it's the age thing.
I've been wondering about that.
Yeah, I think possibly because you're just not as hungry for every 5 minute spot anymore. You know, you're like, you're a bit more discerning. Like, oh God, is it really worth leaving the house? To stand there for 4 hours and wait for my spot.
Oh, you speak my language.
Oh, my God. Seriously. That's partly why I established my own room back in Canberra.
Ah,
you know,
right.
You know, because I just thought, no, fuck this. I want to MC and get my MC chops up. I also want to foster good... I mean, I don't run it now, but I've run rooms for years in Canberra with a dear friend of mine who would volunteer to do ticketing and take photos and social media, Melissa.
So you're a great team by the sounds of things.
Oh, yeah.
Makes it so much better when you can work with good people.
I couldn't have done it without her. She was brilliant.
Do you need more coffee?
No, I'm right. Thanks.
You're right?
Yeah. But,
So you've run
rooms. I've run rooms, yeah. And it's to give yourself stage time as much as anything, as well as fostering other good comedians in the city. And,
yeah.
And
because it's a creative act in itself, really, running a room.
It
how
is.
You how yeah, you want to run
it's a bit of a pain
it.
In the ass, to be honest.
Like, right, I've seen that
it's
too.
It's a pain in the ass. I like it because of what opportunities it gives, but there's a lot of thankless work.
Admin.
And also, comedians can be dicks.
Yeah.
I've discovered that. But it's just like...
Some of them can.
But it's mostly this. What the goal of a comedy night is for the runner of the room is to sell tickets.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
To make money.
Yep.
It is not a charity. Like, it's bad yep. enough working in the arts. I'm not here to just run a room and not make money. I have to make some money.
Yeah.
Like, I've got a family, you know?
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And I hate it when lowly comedians, you know, that want spots, don't promote the show.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, no, I don't feel cool promoting it, or I've got other stuff I want to promote. It's like, what? You're doing 5 minutes. Like, just nuts.
Yeah.
Just to help the bookers out and help promote their shit.
You know, it's really important to hear that side of it because when you haven't run a room and you're always on the other side, we get so self... I mean, a lot of comedians are fairly self-focused anyway.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I will have more.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
No, not at all. Just do that. Yeah.
And then you can be in the world of, well, why aren't I getting a gig? Do you want some soy milk?
No.
Sorry, we're vegan, so yeah.
Great.
So I was with, I don't know if you had a little listen to the Nikki Barry interview that I did.
Sorry, I haven't.
No. It's just I thought, because that's the one I sent you. So she also took, she's run rooms. Have you heard?
Yeah, I know Nikki.
You know Nikki?
I did her Country Women's Association. What is it called? So Chicks with Attitude or something?
Well, it's both.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
It's officially... Comedy Women's Association.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's
and
right.
Then in brackets, Cunts with Attitude.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Hasn't run for quite a while.
Yeah, a few years ago I did it here in Melbourne.
We discussed, so Nikki's run heaps of rooms and we also discussed around what it's like to be the booker. But more from the, you're talking about help the booker out and get some bums on seats, which is, you know, listen, open mic comedians, listen. You know, because I know a booker here that gets really he gets almost aggressive with them with comedians that don't pull their weight and stuff. Oh. And so I've backed off.
I don't think that's good.
No, that's not good. But what you've said makes me understand a bit better why over the years he's gotten so wound up about it.
Yeah, okay, right.
You know, and it's like, well, if we all do our bit and we all get people, it's better for everybody.
Mm.
You know, and it's just. Good to hear it from your point of view. And talking back to, you know, how do you get through and work your way up this comedy world, Nikki was also talking about some rooms like a certain style or a certain flavour.
Well, I guess that's natural, isn't it?
Like, it is.
If you're going to run your own business, it's going to be the business you want to run, right? So,
you're going to employ the people that you get along with.
Yeah, and also you'll have your own biases. Some you might even be aware of. Mostly you won't. So I was always at pains to have a gender-balanced bill when I book people, to have at least 50-50, preferably more women than men.
Yep.
And certainly, you know, people with disability, trans, you know, non-binary, all of the things, I would try and embrace that. And also culturally diverse because there's a lot of white faces out there.
Mm.
And so...
Well, actually, that's interesting. And see here... As time's gone on, it's become way more everything. It's not just white guys on stage anymore here in Melbourne. There have been a lot of... I guess it depends on the gigs.
Yeah, it depends where you go.
Okay.
There's still plenty of fucking white guys. Don't worry about it.
Right, okay. Well, I don't know. Here, look, I think it depends on the gigs you go to, perhaps. But, getting the... It's changed over the years, which is a good thing.
It is good.
But we still need to keep up the work.
Oh, it's just I am baffled. I am baffled that we're in 2022 and there are still gigs. Most big commercial gigs will still have maybe one or two women on the lineup instead of a balance. I don't understand that. I don't understand why in this day and age we still accept that men are comedians and women aren't. You know, why on earth, the audience is 50-50, why on earth would you not have 50-50 on the stage?
Well, what I've heard from some bookers is that they have it's not as easy to get women on the bill.
Oh, that's true. That is true. That can be true.
I think now I'm not saying that I'm not trying to excuse anyone.
No, it's a fair point. It is true.
There were two aspects. There's not as many women on the scene.
Mm.
And also some bookers have told me that they'll call that guy and he'll say yes, and they'll call for that spot, they'll call that guy and say yes, and for this spot they want the woman, and they'll have to call like 10, 15 women to fill the spot. Now, I have no idea.
Well,
what, why, or what's going on?
In my experience, not necessarily even at the national level, just at the Canberra level, for example, I've had gigs where, because I have a lot of women my age that I'm friends with in comedy in Canberra.
Yep.
And in my experience, they're all mums, and they have other priorities. They've got a kid gets sick, or something happens, or they have to, you know, they've got responsibilities, and they can't drop them.
That's right.
And that's the difference between like a mature person with responsibilities and a young person that can just jump up whenever.
Yeah.
I don't know. I had a lot of friends. I'd have to go through friends and just go, can you do it? No, I can't do it. Can you do it? You know, it's because of responsibilities.
Yeah.
And because comedy gets put last because it's just a hobby.
Yeah.
Women won't. Drop everything for it.
And I listened to Johnny Katz because a fair bit, because I like listening to my other people on the scene talk about their experiences. And he interviews young guys, and he also interviews women. I've no issue with who he interviews, but it's just a different group, which is great because I like to cover different people so we can listen to everybody.
Mm.
And he was interviewing Andrew Portelli, and who's been doing very well. He said it when he was peaking before COVID, he was doing between 10 and 14 gigs a week. I can't even imagine doing between 10 and 14 gigs a week. I have no idea what would happen here at home. If I was doing 10 to 14 gigs a week, after 2 or 3 weeks of that, the wheels would be falling off around here because I wouldn't...
Yeah, of course.
I wouldn't be here to fulfil my role.
Mm.
He was a single young man. And that's who you're literally competing against for spots, if you want to see it that way. Maybe when I was in my 20s, if I had been confident or interested.
Well, that's the other interesting part. Like, you've come to comedy late. I came to comedy late.
Nikki came to comedy late as well.
I felt like I had nothing to say in my 20s. And call me crazy, a lot of 20-somethings don't have anything interesting that I want to hear.
I tend to agree.
But I'm amazed by the confidence of showing up and thinking that you do have something to say at 20. I never felt that way. And I take my hat off to them, like, fuck, go you. You know, you're going to be brilliant by the time you're 40.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I just didn't have that. And I wonder if it's a woman thing too, that holding back, waiting till you get the confidence, or you just don't give a fuck anymore and you give it a crack, you know.
Well, I think there's a couple of things at play. Number one, of our generation. Well, you're actually younger than me, so we're not exactly the same generation, but I didn't discover comedy until I was, I'm just trying to think, into my 30s. Mm. And another Grant Cater was talking to me how he saw back in the, let's say, the 80s and 90s, whether it be a huge comedian like Eddie Murphy or maybe George Carlin or my favourite, Bill Hicks, he saw them as magical creatures. That the idea of being able to do what they're doing was far. It was like saying you wanted to be a movie star, you know. Didn't realise at that point there was actually a path, as higgledy-piggledy as it is, there is a path you can follow to become funny. It's not something that you're just born with magically. Some people were the class clown in school. I wasn't.
I was.
You were. Mm. Yeah, which is great.
But it doesn't help with my joke writing.
Really?
No. Not really, no. There's structure and format for jokes. You know, it's one thing to have charisma or whatever and be likeable.
Yeah.
But that doesn't give you good joke writing skills. You've got to develop them.
It's a different skill altogether, isn't it? So I was together with not actually having a history around comedy and then just not having the confidence, just like you. And the other thing, this is an indicator, right?
Mm.
I've interviewed men on this podcast and I've interviewed women on this podcast. Several of the women, when I've asked them, have said, well, I don't know if I'm interesting enough to be on your podcast. No, not one single man has said that. Not one.
And do you expect a reaction from me?
That's the appropriate reaction, which I found fascinating, absolutely fascinating, that we somehow seem to always have ourselves in the background and we've got to get over ourselves and everything else to come forth.
I wanted to do this podcast because you asked me to, and because I like the idea of an older woman doing a podcast, and because you're a comedian, and if there's any knowledge I can share with you that you think is worthwhile, I'm happy to do that.
Fantastic. Mm. You know, thank you, which is great. And I'm hoping that through doing this podcast and me being a female, interviewing people and interviewing at least as many men as women, that we start to see, oh, I don't have to have this, hey, I'm doing this, and hey, I'm doing this feeling that we need to prove ourselves in some capacity. We don't. We're fine exactly the way we are. We can talk about stuff exactly who we are, and it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Just there's this strange phenomenon that, yeah, and I think that might hold us back with coming through with comedy as well, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think as if you haven't had recognition for your skills from industry, it is easy to think you're not worthy, you know? So I think that has helped me. I know that I've got, you know, I know that my story is unusual.
Mm.
And everyone's story is unusual, but I know that mine's worthy of telling. I don't feel any shame or embarrassment. You know, I don't feel unworthy of it. Like, of course I should tell my fucking story. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I found it fascinating. But then I think it's also related. I'm a trained, I've got a Bachelor of Education. So when I did my, I did it years and years ago, but part of the training is that you need to consciously give your female students in a high school teacher as much attention as the boys.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, the boys are always the first to put their hand up. They're always the first to interrupt. They're always the first to yell out, whether it's intelligent or not, that they just dominate the classroom, and the girls will automatically, generally speaking, sort of let it happen. And I remember as a student teacher, I'd already been told about that, but I remember this class and it was just all boys, boys, boys. And without taking the reins and saying, you know, Emma, what do you think?
Yeah.
Bridget, what do you think? Without doing that, it just happened. And I reckon that quality, whatever it is, transfers over onto the comedy scene.
Well, it's just if you're brought up thinking that your voice is important, then you will believe it's important.
And you just come out and say stuff, whether it's intelligent or not, and think it's fucking great. So, what, do you have a time restraint?
Look, it'd be good if we could wrap it up with an hour. That'd be six.
Yeah. Is there anything? I wrote some stuff down here, but we've talked. All right, let's finish on this.
Yeah.
Melbourne crowds, Sydney crowds. Is there a difference? Oh, a Melbourne crowd, Canberra crowds, Sydney crowds. Is that, you've told us that the Canberra crowds are quite intelligent and go for more kind of intelligent stuff. Is there a difference between these crowds?
Look, I'm not the most experienced, you know, travelling comedian. I've only been doing it 10 years and I've only been travelling for about 3 of those. So there would be others that could give you much more nuanced information on that. But in my experience, Sydney crowds are louder.
Right.
They're up for more. They can. They're prepared to have the piss taken out of themselves easier.
Yeah.
Melbourne, I don't know whether it's just this year, particularly since lockdowns and the pain that the Melbourne Knights have suffered, they're a bit more reticent. They're a bit more thoughtful, a bit quieter. And there's not this release. It doesn't feel like they're really releasing themselves in the comedy. They're kind of, they'll laugh at the punchlines and then they'll wait for the next one. It's kind of not this, I don't think it's just me. Like, I've talked to others. It's not just that my show's shit or something. It's just there's a lot of quiet thoughtfulness going on, and I feel like they're sad or they're just not okay at the moment.
Yeah, right.
I don't know whether that's just me. I don't know.
Well, there's been, I've heard other comedians say that Melbourne crowds are very progressive.
Yep.
And that doesn't always let for a great comedy crowd sometimes.
I don't know. I've had great gigs here, but I do think they've been quieter this year than ever before.
Right.
And I don't know what that is, but maybe. I feel like it's a some kind of like group consciousness thing that they're not okay.
Right.
And they're just getting back. Because like everyone's still scared. COVID's still out there, you know.
Yeah.
And people are, you know, dropping gigs left, right and centre.
Yeah, that's right.
Losing money, cancelling gigs. Like, touch wood, I haven't bloody had COVID yet. But, I, you know, we live in fear of having to bloody cancel a show and isolate in a foreign city for 7 days. It's a nightmare for an artist that's already lost so much to COVID. So the crowd is affected by COVID still, I would say. They're scared of it.
You're right.
Yeah.
All right. But I have heard in general that we're more quiet and not necessarily quiet, but more thinking crowd and that Sydney are
Sydney's
more
loose.
Let go.
Yeah, they're loose.
I've heard this from Kritika Harale. Do you know Kritika?
No.
She started in Sydney and she's and she said the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
They're looser up there than they are. But she loves Melbourne. We all love Melbourne. I'm not hanging shit on Melbourne crowds. I'm just, it's good to know.
Mm.
It's good to know if crowds are a little bit different, then you know, okay, it's not you necessarily, even though it's always good to reflect, but
it's good
to know.
Yeah.
And where to, what are you going to do from here? Yeah.
So I'm going to work on a sitcom with Sarah Gall, who's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
A brilliant musical comedian from Sydney. We're going to try and get something up. I'm going to write a new show for next year. I'm touring Sydney, Perth, Brisbane, Byron Bay. And I'm coming back here to film a Just for Laughs gala in June.
Great.
And do some road show.
So Just for Laughs is the Sydney...
No, Just for Laughs is the Montreal Comedy Festival.
You're going to Montreal?
No, I wish I were. But they do an Australian gala that they film for Channel 10, I think.
Oh, really?
So, that's coming up in June, which I'm really excited about.
So you got some really good stuff.
Yeah, some really exciting opportunities.
Your tour, is that on your own or are you going with a group?
On my own.
Right.
So my show, this same show, will go to those places.
Are you going with your show?
Yeah. And then a couple of road shows for the Melbourne Comedy Festival coming up. And
is that with other comedians?
That's with, so that's when the Melbourne Comedy Festival put together a little lineup show, maybe about five or six comedians, and we go to like a bunch of country towns and
So you're on that.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah, it's fun.
Great. Yeah. Have you done country
stuff much before? I did I did 2 weeks in Western Australia with Melbourne Comedy Festival last year.
Yeah.
Like all the way down to Albany, Bunbury, Margaret River, those sorts of places, Kalgoorlie, Perth.
And what are the Perth crowds, the Western Australia crowds like?
Incredible. They're actually wild. They're great.
I can imagine.
They're really up for it, yeah.
I can imagine when you don't have much to choose from. Maybe we're a bit spoiled here.
Yeah, well, that's true. You guys have more comedy than any of us in Australia. So, maybe
that's why we're a bit quieter.
Yeah, that's it.
You better be good. Because we get a comedy anywhere any night of the week.
Exactly right.
Yeah. You didn't go to the mining towns by chance.
Well, Kalgoorlie.
Have you performed for miners?
I assume so because Kalgoorlie's in. That's all they do there.
Because I've heard on podcasts there are got comedians that go to the mine.
Oh no, I haven't gone to a mine.
And I've wondered, how would that go for female comedian?
Fuck. I suppose I'll find out one day. I wouldn't say no. Everything once, you know.
They might love having a female comedian.
I did comedy for the troops, and that was close enough.
Wow.
For me. Middle East, yeah.
You went to the Middle East?
Yeah.
Really? When did you do that?
About 2019.
Can you just quickly tell us and then we can close on that?
Oh, yeah. It was, it was largely men, and it was boiling hot. There was international troops in Iraq. It was just, I never left the compound. Like, they flew us in a Hercules, and it was just unbelievable. It was surreal,
When was this?
This was 2019. Mm.
Wow. And, and you went whereabouts in the Middle East?
Iraq. And
you went to Iraq?
Yeah.
You went to Iraq?
Yeah, I know.
Oh, fuck!
I know, it's unbelievable.
Holy shit, we could do a whole podcast on that.
But it was weird. It was weird to do comedy for such, hardened, hardworking, you know, most people that work for the Defence Force are fucking great people, you know, like, I know you hear other things, but the people I encountered were just, they were away from their family and friends for so long you know, so I had a lot of respect for the people that I met, and it was a difficult circumstance to do comedy.
Was there relatability?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're humans. They got families at home. They, you know, their mum, there were mothers there. There were daughters, sons. You know, like, they get it. They're human. You know, like,
yeah, of course. But their everyday life would be so different. From
I think they love the idea of remembering home. You know, and reliving little memories of their own through your stories.
Of course.
So
they responded well to it.
Oh yeah, they were great. Yeah, they were really good. It was a tough gig. Like, it's outdoors and it's weird, and you know, there's some cultural divides as well. But largely, it was a brilliant experience. One that is one of the most amazing comedy memories I have. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming in.
A pleasure.
And sharing all of your comedy experience,
my
life
pleasure.
Experiences.
Yeah. I wish you all the best. And keep doing it. Yeah.
Well, you're inspiring me to keep doing it, because I can see that there's somewhere, you know, doors do open up if you keep at it and become consistent.
Absolutely.
And I just want to let you know that this is usually an Airbnb room.
Oh, great.
Except we had to get rid of the guests because we got mice and there was water coming through the wall, but yeah, that'll all be fixed. So
sick.
You might
like
to come and stay here next time.
Awesome. Thanks. I'm gonna pitch at the end.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, thanks.